Recorded in their mother's basement, Super Nerdland brings you Graded Point 5, where in a comic book it would be worth less than the polybag it comes in.
Hi, and welcome to Graded Point 5. I'm your host, Jason. With me tonight are John.
Hello.
Dizzy.
Hello there.
Jordan.
Yo.
And Kate.
Yeah.
Before we get rolling, huge spoiler alert. We're not going to hold anything back, so if you don't want stuff spoiled, this probably isn't the show for you. With that said, let's get into it. Tonight, we're doing a classic, a tough one, though. The Crow, 1989 by Caliber Comics, written and drawn by James O'Barr. Jordan, you want to give us a quick synopsis?
Everything is fucking horrible in this fucking book. How's that for a fucking synopsis?
That's a good one. I like it.
Yeah, you're not wrong, you know?
But no, a quick plot overview, if you would.
Certainly. The Crow is the story of Eric, who he and his fiance are murdered, and a being known only as the Crow brings him back to life to take revenge on those who ended his life and the life of his fiance. And so it's the story of everything that goes on in his path to get revenge for the people who did him wrong.
Pretty good synopsis. But it's much more personal than that. Actually, earlier before we were filming, Jordan, you were telling me the backstory of this comic.
Oh, yeah. The backstory for this with James O'Barr is, I forget the exact year, but his fiance at the time, Beverly.
Fiance, yeah.
Yeah, she was struck by a drunk driver, and he ended up enlisting in the Marines to try to cope with the loss that he had suffered. Unfortunately, going into the Marines didn't help him out with that at all, and he started doing paintings to kind of get the venom out of his own mind. And he slowly started working on The Crow. Shortly after he began working on it, he had read in the newspaper about a couple in Detroit, Michigan, I believe it was, who had been killed by a couple of druggies over a $20 wedding ring. So he basically just took all this emotional turmoil and turned it into what is possibly the most fucking depressing comic book I've ever read in my fucking life.
Well, in a good way.
Well, let's look at how James O'Barr managed to turn these ideas into a storyline. And let's start chronologically at the beginning. Jordan, let's say we're in the best possible timeline, right?
Right.
You and your girl get together, and your car breaks down one night. You're waylaid on the side of the road. And a car full of fucking crackhead gangbanger wannabes pulls up on you, proceeds to shoot you in the head twice, and then proceed to rape and then shoot your girlfriend. And you see the whole fucking thing. Because for some reason you just don't die. What kind of broken character would that leave you?
The most broken type of character.
The most broken in the world. There's just...
Yeah. There's no coming back from that, really. Which is made painfully obvious as the story goes on, which I'm not sure if you want me to talk about that just yet.
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
Well, okay. Well, the big thing that I notice, and I really appreciate this, but it also fucking breaks me every time I look at it. After every time Eric goes out, kills one of the druggies who killed him and his fiance, when he goes back to his home, which I believe is the same home that he had bought or had acquired for him and his fiance after they got married.
Well, when they were going to get married.
Right. He has the flashbacks of the happy life that he had with her, which in all there's all, a bit of an art shift as well when it goes to his memories of being with his fiance. And that happens every single time after every person he kills as he gets closer to, you know, the end goal of, you know, getting his ultimate revenge. You see more and more into his psyche, and not only do you see this character cry numerous times, but also there's a huge element of self-mutilation.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was one where he was carving a bunch of X's into his wrist.
And then he drew the Cat in the Hat in his own blood.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So yeah, it's very clear that this person was left hugely broken witnessing all the events that had transpired over the course of that single night.
It made him into the Crow, pretty much. Mm. It was a baptism of fire for the avenging character that James O'Barr puts forth in the books, you know what I mean? Once all those things have been gone through, once he's gone through all that flame, anything's game after that, you know.
Mm. Really heavy.
Yeah. This is not a comic go into, you know, lightly.
But you're like, Jesus fucking Christ. Oh my God.
The whole point is to convey having that part of yourself ripped out. You know, your other half. And in Eric's case, think about it, you don't see him interact with anybody else. He has no friends. He has no family.
Well, yeah. In fact, the only person he has any sort of connection to after he comes back as the Crow is, I forget the character's name, but it's that Sherry. One young girl. Yeah, Sherry, that young girl. Yeah.
But, I mean, before that even, he had nobody. His entire world.
Yeah, his entire world revolved around that woman. And it was, it's...
Don't put your eggs in one basket, I guess. I'm kidding.
Jesus Christ.
Fucking
well, I mean...
On one hand, he's not wrong.
I had to lighten the mood there. I think we're all going to start carving stuff into ourselves.
You gotta have some hobby. In the event that this thing happens, God forbid, you gotta still have something that can distract you. Jesus Christ.
But,
to be fair, if Eric could have just had like a D&D group... Maybe it wouldn't have.
Yeah, you see, you're on the right track.
It's in the last page of the book, I believe. It just says, get a hobby, you know.
Jesus.
Next time, try polygamy.
Exactly. Just get that replacement girl. It's no big deal.
The Mormon
Crow.
There's
nothing wrong. Nothing wrong with it. Come on, man.
Ugh.
Jesus Christ.
Now, what really struck me is how much the character changed. You know, before he became the Crow, Eric seemed like a pretty level-headed kind of guy. Mm-hmm. You know, utterly in love with Shelley and all that, but he didn't seem morbid and distraught and shattered. But after, he's almost like this wicked jester of sorts. Running around spitting rhymes in these, like, statements that don't seem to make much sense while shooting people in the face.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you do.
It's funny. It is a reoccurring... I don't think you can have a story of vindication, of a vendetta, and just have it as a plain, straightforward vendetta. Usually in good vendetta stories... And there's some truth to this as well. You'll always find that the protagonist themselves become the thing that they either hate or go through some sort of metamorphosis whereby a mirror is shown up what they've become, if you know what I mean. Mm. Now, he kind of goes through that, I feel, in this, in a way. And I think that's what the character Sherry is there for, is to anchor the character in a way. But you can see it in other books and movies as well, that this is it's a similar theme that goes through a lot of different media.
Yeah, and the character change in The Crow is so stark. It really sticks out in your mind when you think about, you know, comic book vendetta stories where the main character becomes so damaged. It's like, you got the Punisher, you know, who pretty screwed up individual, but he's got nothing on Eric.
Well, yeah, I think the biggest element of that just simply comes down to a lot of these Vendetta characters and Vendetta antiheroes. They don't establish that despair that causes some people to go to that point. You know, the Punisher, yeah, you understand that his family was killed because he stepped on some toes. But there's no point in that where the Punisher breaks down in tears. It's literally a moment of, I'm a fuck up everything that these fucking lawbreakers do because of what happened to my family. Whereas in The Crow, literally everything that he's doing is based on that emotional turmoil, which of course is punctuated with after every time he kills somebody, memories of that person he lost at the hands of these people comes back and he has his crying fit and he mutilates himself or does whatever he has to do to kind of deal with it emotionally.
You know what I think it is? I was thinking about it before, earlier on today, as to what is it about. What did I feel when I first read the book, etc., etc. And there's a lot of things. Obviously, the first thing that you notice about the book is how dark it is compared to other things that I read at that age. But one thing I have to say about the character of Eric is that he's the hero or anti-hero. But even with, like you mentioned, the Punisher, Punisher has moments and you're like, oh man, badass, you know, he's an absolute ruthless badass. And that's kind of like, it kind of like tones into, and it hooks into something in you, at least, like a lot of heroes do. But with Eric, he is the most unenviable character, I think. Like, I don't want to be him for a second, even with all the kind of cool imagery and kind of like amazing artwork that goes through and scenes that goes through, that are peppered throughout the book. I never want to be Eric. I have no envy of him at all throughout any part of the book, because it's so well communicated, that loss. This is such a massive communication of loss in this, and that's what really hit me. I was probably about 12 when this 12 no not even I think it was I was about 12 when I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the first thing I read that communicated that sort of loss at that time, and I hadn't experienced love or anything like that, and but it still managed to do that. And I think that's something definitely noteworthy, but definitely for sure. The character Eric, I feel from it, what makes him different from other people, he's not enviable at all at any stage throughout this book.
Mm.
Actually, I completely agree with that. I read this, God, when I was in the early 2000s, I guess, just when I was getting back into comic books after my childhood. Starting to be in my teenage years, getting into comic books, finding all this cool stuff and going, oh, The Crow, that's a film, right? I'll read the comic book first and see what the film's like. For me, The Crow's never been about, never been a story about revenge. It's purely a story of loss. Because the actual villains of the piece, the people who did the crime, who killed Eric, killed his fiance and everything, they're really not a threat at any point to the Crow, to the character. They're always just someone he just deals with in a almost, you know, throwaway manner. The whole driving force of the story and of the character is loss and the obsession that comes with the feeling when you've lost someone that you love or that's meant something to you. You have this mindset where you just focus on them. You just focus on these memories that just tear at you. It's the kind of thing that you can't really convey to people how destructive that kind of mindset is. And we're not really sure. It's never really implied, like, that obviously he had this incredible relationship with his fiance, but like was mentioned earlier, did he have a life outside of that? When you've gone through a loss, you don't think about your life outside of the person. You just think about them. And that's kind of feeding the character after it becomes the Crow. It's feeding that desire for, not necessarily for revenge, but just to get this task done so I can just end those thoughts.
Yeah.
It's really, like you said, like, exactly, but the for me, the character, when they did the film adaptation, they made it more about the revenge story, but you have to do that for, you know, because it's a movie, so you're going to do that anyway. Exactly. But for the comic, it's just like, they could almost have not had the revenge story, and it would have been just as interesting. You wouldn't have had that kind of cool badass, those badass moments. But the strength of those is the dissonance between that would be a badass moment in any other comic, but in this, because you've experienced the loss with the character, it's just devastating almost. How well done it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Just on what you were saying there about that whole portrayal of loss, of absolute loss, it's worth noting, because I went in earlier on just to for the podcast, I just had a quick look at James O'Barr. I think it's worth noting that when he was being interviewed when they released the movie in 1994, he was asked if it helped making, because he made the graphic novel as a catharsis, and he pretty much admitted that it didn't. He actually went unfulfilled from it. He told an interviewer in 1994, and this is from the Wikipedia: "As I drew each page, it made me more self-destructive. If anything, there is pure anger on each page, and it didn't. So it's obviously, like, you can almost feel that. At the end of the book, there isn't much emotional. I mean, it's in my opinion, from my memories of reading it, what it leaves you with, there isn't a resolve. This is, you're still left with loss by the end of the book. So this is what you're saying, Jordan. It's very depressing.
Absolutely, too. It also goes a long way to kind of show how destructive an obsession can be, because. Like, the only reason that he did it was because he was obsessed with just the person, and that was it. And like you say, in a weird meta way, that reflects the what happened to James O'Barr as well. He's doing this thing to try and help, and it didn't. You know, it's just made it worse.
Yeah. You can see the parallels he draws between his own experience and the character. Like, even the fact that, like, I don't think it's a coincidence that his fiancée in real life was hit by a car, and then also the event that transpired between Eric and his fiancée was around a car as well. Do you know what I mean? I think there's lots of stuff like that that kind of seeps in and out and is intertwined in the book from him and his life. So yeah.
Now, what really got me, especially, you know, the whole thing being about loss, is the situation that sparks it all is something that could happen to anyone. Obviously not to that much of an extreme, though it's still theoretically possible. But having a situation like that is something that could happen to any of us. And that loss is supposed to be relatable. Because, you know, it could happen to you. We could wake up tomorrow, read it, you know, on news websites or Twitter or something. You know, to some happy young couple, you know, with a broke down car getting killed by a bunch of drug addicts.
Yeah, it happens more than you think.
It happens a lot, yeah. I mean,
well, hell, you could even go take it further. It's just the pain of loss, intense pain from loss, is such a human thing that it's probably one of the most relatable emotions that we as humans feel outside of maybe love and happiness.
But my bigger point is, you know, there's that loss of power and control as well.
Mm-hmm.
That feeds into it. You know, you're going to lose something that matters to you at some point in your life, and you're not going to be powerless to do a fucking thing about it.
Right.
You know, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, could die of cancer, not a fucking thing you could do.
Mm-hmm.
Get hit by a drunk driver, not a fucking thing you can do. Yes, the only thing you can do is recover.
Oh, not, yeah, exactly, yeah. It is that one turning point. I mean, that is it, the one turning point in your life where things can go absolutely down the gutter, you know. And you do read about it every day, and you just, you know, I think that is definitely something.
And that's the honestly kind of scary thing about the book, is realizing that someday something like that could happen to you, and there's not a damn thing you can do to stop it. And there's going to be no crow to help you get revenge.
So I don't know how well you guys all remember, but One of the most important, I think one of the most symbolic kind of parts, and it might even be cliched by nowadays standards, but it's quite one of the most notable parts in the book is a memory. It's not really a memory. It's obviously some sort of like vision that Eric's having where he's on a train. I don't know if you remember this, and there's a horse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's near the start. I think it's at the start of the book, but he's on a train and he's looking out the window and there's a white horse. Going alongside the train, and he's looking at very fondly at the horse, etc., etc. And then this is exactly leading up to what you're. I think this ties in nicely what you were saying there, Jason. That he sees the horse, and the horse is looking at him, and he's about regarding his sugar and each other, and he's looking out at this beautiful white horse, and then the horse runs into this barbed wire fence, and gets cut up, much to his absolute horror. Like it's graphic and. The horse gets caught up in the barbed wire and, you know, and gets left behind. And he's watching the horse, obviously, you know, writhe in pain or perhaps die, stuck in this barbed wire fence as the train moves forward. I think that's definitely, because it's early on in the book, that's the first thing that kind of raw imagery strikes you as like, oh my God, okay, so even if you're naive about reading into imagery, it's very straightforward as to what's being told there, like that he moved ahead. Whereas his fiance died, and she's nowhere, because like he gets resurrected, she doesn't get resurrected, she's gone, she's a memory in his head, and imagery like that that James O'Barr sticks into the book is the stuff. They're the parts that really translate the sense of loss, and that I think that only, and it's not faked as well. You know, the crow gets a. At least in my experience and over here in Ireland, the crow is tied up to a lot of kind of the goth scene and the emo scene and all this sorts of stuff, which are very commonly parodied and whatnot. But this is the real deal sort of thing. The stuff that the imagery that he puts across in it, you know, for sure.
But
speaking of trains,
well then,
quick, hide your horses.
See the imagery I was trying to invoke here.
this is planned, was it?
Oh yeah,
very good.
Cost me an ass load of money to get that train too, man.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah.
I had to call in a few favors and I had to do a few things. Let's not talk about it.
I'm not too proud to admit my butthole was involved, but no.
Couple things was involved. Okay, though. Okay, now. Anywho.
Yeah, little derailing there. God damn it, I did not mean that.
Ain't la mau.
Oh, wow. Ain't la mau.
Ain't la mau.
But yeah, it's really hard to read this comic and not come out the other side. Even if you haven't lost much in your life, feeling like you've lost something. That feeling just permeates every page. And the anger. I mean, this is an aggressive comic.
It's visceral, yeah.
You're seeing people get their legs cut off, heads blown off. It's just a very bloody comic. And oddly enough, it's not stifled at all by the fact that it's in black and white.
If anything, I think that actually adds a lot more to, adds a lot more to the kind of the stark sort of what's the word I'm looking for here. I think the black and white adds to it. So like it's kind of cheap, nearly to just. Put it red and everything.
As you yeah,
Judge Dredd, like the comedic levels of blood and whatnot. Whereas with this, it's something very dark and shadowy and very hidden, nearly and whatnot in the negative space in the artwork. You know, and that's another thing I think that's worthwhile getting into is the James O'Barr's style, because it's kind of like a slightly. And don't be wrong. I mean this in the nicest way possible. But it has this lovely naive sort of like quality to it. In terms of proportions and anatomy and everything like that, but it works so well. It's unmistakable as being the crow. You know what I mean? It has its own look, and definitely, and the black and white definitely attributes to that as well.
But yeah, And the artwork is, even though, like you said, the proportions are a little awkward, it sticks in your mind. It's memorable. Even, like, the scenes without the crow in it.
Completely. It's, absolutely.
But, you know, it proves that you can get, you know, a gory, violent panel across and not use a single drop of red. Mm-hmm. And without going to, you know, Frank Miller cartoony levels with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, definitely.
And it's, you know, always interesting to see a character self-mutilate.
Yeah, I mean, you don't say that to me. Well, I don't read comics often, but... You just read, as I'd like to.
You read comics when I tell you to.
Yeah, I don't know. I should read more often. You might have seen it more often. I don't know.
But even just about going on, it is worth noting as well with the black and white is that if you look at all the memories he has with his fiancée, they are all in white, you know. White with black outlines. It's all very lovely and sort of like...
soft.
Wispy and feminine and has a lovely quality to it. And it's almost like the best artwork in the book is the artwork with his fiancée. It's done very well. It uses negative space a lot. Whereas then when he's actually in... the act of like going into these buildings or alleyways or whatever, and he's killing these people. It's all very kind of nearly has a cluttered feel to it with the black and white. Now, obviously, I'd say that's very, very intentional, but it is worth looking back at the panels where he's actually and see just the difference in art style between the memories with his fiance and then when he's actually in the act of vengeance and whatnot, when he's actually back in reality, as it were, whatever reality that is, but back in reality, it's very much jolts you back with that with those two different styles. I think that's something that really stuck with me when I read the book initially as well.
Now, one thing that really stuck with me was how intelligent this book also was. Referencing Milton in one part, you know, various poets. It's smart at times when it's not disjointed and half psychotic. And like,
I'd also say one of my favorite things that was used was some Joy Division lyrics.
Yes,
being from Manchester, hey. I'm going to be biased towards that, but it really kind of speaks to because was alluded to earlier, this is very much kind of one of the key sort of cornerstones of at least in the UK as well as Ireland. It was kind of like the goth and emo stuff that came in the kind of the wave that came in the late 90s, early 2000s. This was a big part of that. It was, you know, the makeup and stuff like that, and using quotes and this idealization of self-harm. It wouldn't all be from the crow, but it certainly played a big part in it. From, you know, my friends who were into that scene at the time. But I think that comes from kind of a fundamental misunderstanding of the book as a whole, because the book isn't like, there's nothing wasted. They're not doing anything for shock value. They're not doing anything for just to sell copies. They're doing it because James Obar wrote it because he wanted to have this very specific message that came across. And the use of things like Milton and Joy Division lyrics and some of the other quotations that were used in between the issues, they weren't there because the looked cool, you know. They were there because they were completely applicable to the story and carried the same themes with it. So I think it's why that kind of thing, you know, if you read that and you're already a little bit inclined to be into a goth or an emo scene or whatever, you're gonna be like, oh, that's so cool, I'm gonna dress up like the crow and I'm gonna do all this stuff and listen to Joy Division and read Milton.
That happened
when you've got absolutely no understanding of what it means. This is a comic book about, like I said earlier, this is a comic book about revenge and loss. It's not about trying to be
cool.
It's not an edge scene. Yeah.
Exactly. It predated any of that kind of stuff.
They really did, yeah. And it's funny, I have the memory now of a few lads going around Dublin dressed up as that, and it was very cringy altogether. But yeah, that was the only bad thing about the Crow, is that it did have that sort of it did lead on to that. But whatever, it's a silly thing to complain about. Whatever, everyone has their thing. But yeah, for sure, you don't have to come from any sort of like appreciation of goth or emo or any of that sort of stuff to completely feel what's going on here. Because if you look at James O'Brien, he's not like that at all. He's just a regular dude, you know. He doesn't go around dressed up like he's out of the Matrix or anything like that, you know. He's just a Joe Soap, you know, like anyone else. And that's very important to bear in mind when you're reading this book for the first time, that this did start a trend, this look. This did start a lot of things in terms of that visual style with the younger generation, you know.
That's why there's a joke called, this is back when I cared more about, like, goth subculture when I was younger. There was a joke that some people would try too hard and it would be called crow makeup. Yeah. So, like, they would just do all the weird drawings. They don't do that greasy white shit on their face, the white face. Just go completely disgusting. So, yeah. I don't know. I was just remembering that because.
Yeah, it's all over the shop. It's not applied right. It looks wrong. I remember. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
And they work inevitably at a Hot Topic.
Yeah, and they have all those gauges and shit, and you're like, oh my god.
This just reminds me of the conversation we were having when we were talking about John the Homicidal Maniac.
Oh yeah.
Just people radically missing the fucking point of the book.
They're just reading exactly. It because they're like, oh, this is so cool. No, fuck you. Piece of shit. This is not. Go away.
Kate, I think you're the only one who thinks like that.
Some people read shit like that. And he's like, fuck off. You'll understand. You understand me, okay? Too cool for all y'all bitches. Anyway. I don't know why you guys aren't stopping me.
We just want to see where you'll go.
Yeah. Watching it'll you go derail very bad this fucking places. Podcast is always hilarious.
It's going to go bad places. Stop me.
Oh, I could always make it go to worse places.
I could start cussing now.
Oh no, not that.
Oh, what do you fucking do?
They're using the N-word.
No, none of that. We're going to try to keep it at least a little tame here.
Just kidding. Anyway.
But no, I could always just start railing on Jordan.
Oh, here we go. Here we fucking go. I'm waiting for this shit. Bring it. Come on, motherfucker. Let's go.
Is this where we stop talking about the comic book and just completely start, like, you know?
this is where Jason takes all of my insecurities about developing emotional connections with people, and he just beats me over the head with it.
Oh, is this what you're going to do to Dick?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, pretty my much, God.
Yeah. That would have been horrible. It would have been greater because you would have been right there to watch.
Aww. He was literally going to wait until we got to the point talking about... Shelly's fucking raped and be like, Dick, what would you do if that happened to Kate?
Oh, it would be terrible. It would be absolutely destroyed. Oh.
Well, Jordan, what would you do if it happened to Burger?
Jesus Christ. Fucking. I wouldn't be able to. I'll be honest. I would not be able to cope with that shit.
Less the usual response. that's how you should be.
Yeah. I mean, if you'd answered anything else, I would have questioned your sanity.
Well, you should do that regardless.
I mean, that's the point. Something like this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to live with that piece of you missing for the rest of your fucking life.
Here we go.
Here comes the part where Jason tries to, you know, reduce me to tears.
Knowing that all the time and effort and emotion you put into that person is just gone and has nowhere else to go. Just that void sucking it out of you.
Well, yeah, that is something that, like, the immediate aftermath of a situation like that would bring upon a person. But I also think it's one of those things that, like, the old adage of time heals all wounds definitely applies there.
That's such bullshit, though. It doesn't ever heal it. It may make it hurt less.
Well, that's the thing.
It never goes away.
No, something like that can never be healed. But what it essentially will just do is as time goes on, the clarity of your memories fades. So it's very dulled.
Sorry to interrupt, Jordan. I actually found that you said that's quite interesting because. I think that if someone experiences a loss or indeed anything that really affects them, you have that initial pain, you know, that initial like shock and the sense of loss, and it's just there and so raw and so obvious in your mind. But then as you move further and further through your life, that pain starts to lessen. And that's kind of what most people say when they say time heals all, which, like Jason said, that's bullshit. Because the pain that is lessened, it doesn't really go anywhere. It just manifests itself in different ways. You can have an event happen, and then years later, it completely fucks you up in a way you'd never thought about. Mm-hmm. And it's still that event that's doing it. It's still that loss that's, you know, made you the way you are. I'm not going to get too personal here, but I had a loss early in my childhood that's still affecting me now, 20 years later. I don't mind talking about it. I'll talk about it to anyone. But I'm very, very much aware that it's just now part of my brain. My brain is actually different. I think about things in a different way because of that event, you know? And I'm still like, I'm never sad about it at this point. I'm like, I can think about the person that I lost and everything and have happy memories, but I'm still massively fucked up because of it.
Right, of course.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you can only go ahead.
That's basically what would have happened, I think, if... I don't know, some douchebag. Well, yeah, would have carried it on, and it would have been a big sort of treatise on the nature of loss. Which, I mean, we get that enough in our own lives anyway. No, that's not what it's about. It's more about the initial kind of impact of it. And I'm certain that James O'Barr would actually say now that, yeah, he's still dealing with it and he's still devastated by it. But maybe that wasn't the best thing to do, was writing the crawl to try and help. But you never know until you try, you know?
That's the thing. You're pretty much going to shoot in the dark. I mean, God, how do you even begin to get over something like that? I couldn't possibly imagine. I'm quite blessed. I haven't been through any major tragedies in my life. It's exact saying. I don't know what I'd do. You know, it's crazy. But getting back into the meat and the bones of the comic, though, and I don't know if you remember this as well, but like what I really liked about the comic, though, just in terms of going into format and going into structure, what I really liked about the comic was the whole, like, each chapter was broken up into different tasks as to what to do, you know. So it opens up with who dies first, that T-Bird guy or whatever, I can't remember, guy in the alleyway, I think it's the first thing we see, and it's... Anyway, whatever. But what I really like is like, it's not just him going off and he's going off and killing a whole bunch of people. But the way he ties in the story with his life with Shelley back to that, for example, he goes to the pawn shop. And it's also a scene in the movie that's very good. That's actually very well done in the movie, but I think it's exactly the same as in the movie. But he goes and to get the wedding ring back, or the engagement ring back, that's what it was, because it gets pawned off. Mm-hmm. Stuff like this. That's what I really like. What I really liked about it in terms of the storytelling itself is that everything anchors to itself. You know, everything anchors back to the pain, you know? So it's not just him going off and killing a whole bunch of people. It's him going off and killing each person, and each person has an artifact of that night, if you get me, that gets kind of revealed, if you know what I mean, as the story goes on.
Hmm.
Really, really well done, you know. Pain, as you said before, depressing as hell, but really well done, I have to say.
Now, what gets me is, almost ironic nature of going into something to try to provide catharsis and only finding impotent rage and anger on it, you know?
Oh, yeah, completely.
And that can be a part of loss. I know that part well. Trying to do something to get it out and you just wind up angrier.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't help.
No, it rarely does. It is. It's a cheesy old adage, but you do become the thing that you hate, or as it were. And like I said before at the start, like this is something that's very much a popular theme in vengeance movies. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the movie Dead Man's Shoes.
Yeah.
For example, that's a perfect example of this sort of thing. It's a revenge story between a man comes back to a small town where he confronts once again a gang of thugs, local drug dealers and thugs who pretty much bullied his brother into committing suicide. His mentally challenged brother into committing suicide. But it has a similar. I don't want, without ruining it for people, I highly recommend watching it. Fantastic movie. Shane Meadows directing, writing and directing, Paddy Costigan. But to me, it actually just springs into mind. Look about The Crow, like that similar theme throughout media, with revenge stories and stuff like this. That it's never just I'm just going to go off and kill everyone and that's the end of the story. I got everyone. It's always a journey, and a mirror being held up to the protagonist as to, is this helping anything? Is this changing anything? Because that's the thing is in The Crow as well, is the don't look, you know, the crow keeps shouting to him, don't look, because that's what happened. Like, don't look at what they're doing to her. Don't look at what he can't help but look. And that's a part of his kind of self-destruction even after he's being resurrected, you know?
Yeah.
Which is the opening lines in the Cure song, which is a really, really good song on the soundtrack for the movie. But yeah,
it's same, Burn.
It's the same thing. Yeah, it's fantastic. But yeah, it's. I think that's it's just worth noting. I think definitely that it is a running theme with vendetta movies, because I think vendetta movies would be kind of pointless and boring if there wasn't that sort of journey for the protagonist. You know.
Mm.
Now another thing I found interesting was how throwaway almost the antagonists are. Like, you don't grow any attachment to them. They don't matter. They're just there for that anger to be taken out on. They're almost as much just, you know, plot devices more than characters.
Stereotypes, I mean.
Yeah. Just a way for, you know, Eric to take out his anger and frustration. A way to try to make you feel like that if you find a way to something to take your anger out on, the loss won't hurt as much. But in the end, Eric becomes more and more unstable. You know, he's cutting himself more and everything, and the death don't matter.
I suspect that was done very deliberately, actually, because a lot of revenge things, like, you know, in comics, the Punisher and other characters like that, the villains are often, you really see how evil they are. You spend quite a lot of time getting, you know, building them up, making them seem like a threat, making the payoff worth it. For this, we spend hardly any time with the villains. We're aware of what they did, but we don't know anything about the characters. We know they're bad, I guess, but that's about it. But it's because it's not about them. It's about Eric. No, it's a story just about his coping with it. And they could be replaced by anyone. You could change the names, you could change the gender, you could change the race, you could change anything. And it wouldn't make a difference because it's not about them. They're just sort of there to have a point for the character, really.
Exactly. And I found that really interesting because, you know, like you said, we're always building up these villains in comics. And it's not very often you see a completely throwaway villain anymore. And here we've got a book full of it because it's not about them. And to me, it almost shows more skill to be able to write a stereotypical throwaway killer and draw, you know, stereotypical throwaway character, and have it still be interesting. Because after a while, you'd think it's just, oh, nameless guy A, you know, red shirt, got killed. But with this, you're still looking at it going, wow, that's, you know, differently drawn character, but still a character caricature, you know? And it's still interesting to watch Eric go through it. You know, kill them, or in one case, make them kill themselves. Which, that was probably one of the more interesting points to me. He goes out of his way to kill all these other guys, you know, to the point where he's able to look them in the eyes when they die 90% of the time. But he lets Funboy go with just overdosing? I mean, the guy who literally raped the corpse of his fiance, and he's just going to let him off himself? Did that kind of strike anybody else as odd, too?
For me, that struck me as, like, great. Obviously not that, you know, he did that, but the character development at that point.
Yeah.
He was getting to a point where he just didn't care. Like, it didn't, to him, it didn't matter anymore.
As long as they died.
Like, as long as they die, I don't care how you do it, just die. I'm beyond the point of revenge. It doesn't matter to me. All that matters is that you're all dead, so I can go and, I can stop existing, basically. It didn't strike me as odd, actually. I thought it was fantastic, sort of, I think a lesser writer would have, you know, he would have promised to make his death quick or whatever. And then he would have gone, haha, but I lied.
Yeah.
And shot him and tortured him or whatever. But no, he just let him do it because at that point, Eric just didn't care. He was just like, nope, I'm done. I'm getting this over with. And that's it.
In fact, if memory serves, only one character gets tortured at all. Well,
yeah,
two.
Yeah,
two. The one where he cuts off the dude's...
Where he cut his fingers off, right?
Yeah, Shelby the Giant. He cut off the dude's fingers and made him eat him.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the first kill you see in the comics where he cuts the dude's feet off.
Yeah, lets him
bleed out.
Well, I was going to say, because that's not really torture. He just kind of just doesn't fucking care.
But it's... Those are the only points where it's not, you know, at least...
He's not blowing people's heads off.
Yeah, a clean, quick death.
Yeah, I think that there is. I think that if you look through the comic, like, they are a lot of just disposable bad guys. You know what I mean? Strewn throughout. So the one criticism I would have that seems strange to me in the whole comic is that a lot of the... they don't see... it's like he got a whole bunch of, like, bad guy tropes from different types of bad guy. Like, you have the guy with the dreads, you've got the white junkie guy, you've got the guy with the shades, you know, and he just kind of threw them together in this quote-unquote gang. It just doesn't seem to make any sense that any of them would ever hang out with each other, you know what I mean? This is one of the funny things that is about the bad guys in The Crow. Like, it just seems a little bit out of place, a little bit strange. But that might also play into the whole... That might go back to what you were saying about it's nearly irrelevant, who these characters are, what they are, etc., etc. Maybe that's what he was doing when he was writing it, is that he wanted to just show different elements of what he saw as kind of scumbags in society at the time, you know? So maybe. But it is funny, like, if you look back through the comics, it's kind of like, none of these guys would really know each other, from my experience anyway. I just thought it was funny to note that now, looking back in it now and looking at it, you know?
Or at the very least, they might know each other, but they certainly wouldn't be fucking hanging out.
No, of course, not in a car and going out and killing people and raping.
Yeah, not, you know, running around in a car, smoking crack, killing and raping.
Exactly, yeah.
They just don't seem like that kind of friends.
I would genuinely have loved it if it had just gone all out and thrown in like a 30s gangster in there as well. some guy with a Tommy gun going like, see, we're going to rape your girlfriend, see?
just
a black knight, a dude in a suit of armor, you know, just gets out of the car.
A Roman centurion.
Roman centurion, oh, yeah. Exactly.
And one of the guys from Clockwork Orange.
For good measure, yeah.
Yeah, just get all your bases covered at once. Dear God, how are we able to make jokes about this?
Because we're all fucked up in the head.
Lots of alcohol. It's because we're all damaged here.
So okay, one thing I forget is there isn't ever any sort of resolve or explanation as for what the crow is, because he first sees the crow when he's about to be killed, or he's about to, he gets shot in the head once, he falls to his knees. When he looks up for the second shot, the crow comes over, the bad guy, I can't remember the fellow who shoots him in the head, his shoulder, and he's kind of like a hair, like it's okay sort of thing, and don't look, don't look. But after that, he gives him advice, he tells him what's what, and etc., etc. But he, I don't think we ever actually find out, though, do we? Like, it's nearly just a throwaway narrative piece that works really well. Obviously, he is the crow now, etc., etc. But we never, there isn't any resolve to that, as far as I remember from the book, is there?
No, it just kind of ends. It just, you know, he kills the last guy, kind of just drops, and that's it.
Well, there you go.
I think that kind of makes it more bleak, too. It's like,
of course, yeah.
It's not like, they could have had the nice ending. Oh, they were reunited in the afterlife and bullshit. But no, it's just, here's that loss, here's that need for vengeance, and then nothing. You know, it just stops.
Right, yeah. Well, I think we should talk about the ending, though, as well. Are we at that? How far into this are we now?
Because, just go for it, man.
Because, like, you know, the ending of it kind of reminded me, looking back on it, kind of reminded me of the end of Mad Max 1, you know, when he has your man, he handcuffs him to the car sort of thing, you know? When we have to, it's the same sort of scenario where there's a crash car and he walks up and we get the impression that he beats him to death with a hammer, you know?
Yeah.
But then after that, it's just, he goes to Shelley's grave and reminisces one last time, and then he kills himself from what we can understand from the last few panels. So, like, yeah, sorry, I actually have it in front of me so I can quote it. So he's sitting down, he says, "Remember when you said mine and I said forever, and you said only forever? It's forever now." So, and then the forever now panel, it has the gun. So we assume then that he kills himself. You know, it's the most logical thing. But then the last panel is strange, where it says end, because it has this figure, this silhouetted figure that looks like Eric, kind of, with long hair. It's walking off into the distance. So that's always puzzled me, because, like, that means that that's either one of a few things. Like, he killed himself and he's still wandering, and then in the afterlife, it's fucking depressing as shit, because he still doesn't get back with Shelley. You know what I mean? He doesn't meet Shelley, or he's not with her forever. So that always freaks me out.
I can explain the ending. After he kills himself, cool. He causes third impact.
Oh, so this is instrumentality. Okay.
Yep, that's why he's all alone. he didn't do the thing that Shinji did, where he's like, fuck everybody. I'm gonna wander by myself. That's why you got those pillars. It's Judeo-Christian imagery, guys. It's very basic.
God damn it.
Come on.
See, I just thought after the comic ended, Eric went off and became a wrestler for WCW.
Very good. Very good.
I'm sure that's what happened.
You know, that would explain a hell of a lot.
Well, I think there was an author's version or the ultimate edition of The Crow that was released a few years ago, or whatever it was, a few extra bits and pieces, but maybe that's at the end of it. Maybe he's at the grave and he says, "You said forever," and he goes, "But hang on a second, wrestling, you know?" And then Ed McMahon comes up and goes,
"Vince,
you know," Ed McMahon, fucking Vince McMahon comes up and is like, "Hey, kiddo," you know? Gives him a shot, you know? The rest is history.
Wait a minute. Those gangsters didn't kill my fiance. That bastard Hulk Hogan did.
And thus starts an epic, you know, storyline.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Ah, you have to take the piss.
Well, yeah, if you don't joke about it, it's gonna fucking eat you alive. I mean, I'm glad I went through the loss I did before I read this comic. Because I would really hate to have something I love as much as comics be responsible for me being dead inside.
Yeah, that would suck.
No, but I think everyone takes something different from it, you know, so... that's the thing. Like, I mean, like I said, like, when I first read this, like, very happy-go-lucky life, etc., etc., and this is kind of the first thing that had really stark, kind of real sort of imagery about loss and stuff in it that I think I'd ever seen in that, at least in that format, so, for sure. But I think, yeah, everyone who's a fan of Crow comic, graphic novels, I think, takes a little bit of their own piece away from it, if you know what I mean. Yeah. For sure.
Ooh. It's okay. Just really strong imagery, though, you know, having Eric on Shelley's grave with the gun and saying, you know, it's forever now, and just ending it like that. It just leaves, you know, just enough to the imagination to sit there for, you know, a couple hours and think about it. You know, what would it do anything for him to actually shoot himself in the head at that point? Would he die? And if he died, would he go, you know, where would he go from there, you know? Because nobody knows what happens after death, and anybody that claims to is a fucking fool. You know, would he have forever, or would it just end? That's kind of a hard thing to think about.
Mm.
I mean, it's enough that we've been killing each other for thousands of years because people have a different idea what happens when you die. It's just, yeah. This comic gets entirely too depressing and thought-provoking at times. And by at times, I mean at any point from the front cover to the back cover.
The entire fucking way through.
Yep.
All of it. Fuck all of it.
But I gotta admit, you really don't sound as broken as I thought you would, Jordan.
Well, it's one of those things. I mean, it's... yeah, I'm not necessarily broken, but it made me take a look at myself in an inward fashion, which I never like to do because there's a lot of fucking disturbing shit in there.
Yeah.
But it
most yeah. involving anyway. Japanese cartoon girls.
Yeah, indeed, fucking, sir.
You fucking degenerate.
Exactly. But it's one of those things that I ask myself, if I suffered the same situation that Eric did, and if I was gifted with the same abilities, you know, nigh invincibility, would I not turn into a similar monster? And I'm pretty sure the answer would be, yeah, in like 2 seconds. I mean, I wouldn't just stop at the people who fucked my life up. I'd just go around killing everybody.
Everyone's going to suffer.
That's neither here nor there.
So, yeah. Yeah,
not broken, just very, very, well, it's like you said, it's very thought-provoking. And it makes me think about the way that most people deal with loss, and, I don't know. It makes me feel all the things I don't want to feel.
Get used to it.
Well, I think that was, you know, the intention, though, is to feel what you don't want to feel because it's uncomfortable.
Mm.
Yeah.
So instead of, you know, saying, why don't you think about it? It's like, no, here, I'm going to shove your face in it, you know, rub it around and make it as uncomfortable as I can.
Now what?
Sounds like my average sex life.
Yeah.
Yeah, rub your face in it, tell me how it smells, right?
It pretty much, yeah.
Like that,
yeah.
Disgusting.
Anyway. So, we get to the inevitable final question for the night. Would you suggest this to anybody? It's not an easy question, is it?
It's like, depends on the person and why I'm suggesting it.
I would say definitely. I would definitely suggest it, but I would also offer that suggestion with a warning of just be aware of what you're going to be reading.
You're not ready.
You know, it's not easy to read. It's very dark. It's going to make you look at pain and loss and suffering, and it's going to make you look at yourself in a different way than you ever thought you would previously. But I would definitely still recommend it, because just the fact that a piece of a graphic novel could evoke that kind of emotional change in a person is important to me. Any piece of media that can make me think very long and hard about my life and about who I am as a person, I think is something that more and more people need to introduce themselves to.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I have, suggested this comic over the years to plenty of people, and most of them have seemed to like it. I would question if any of them understood it, you know. But that's back to, like you said, you know, it depends on the person.
Like yourself, Jason, I've recommended this to a number of different people, and it's kind of it's not one I'd recommend in the first instance at all. If someone goes, what graphic novel should I read? I've never read any before. What are five I should read? This isn't on the top five, because it's not. It's only the kind of thing you can appreciate if you already know a little bit about graphic novels, because if you gave it to someone and they just started reading it, they'd be like, what the fuck is this? Why have you told me to read this? This is absurdly, like, difficult. And they'd have to read something else, like, you know, We Three, maybe. Break him in with that. Break him in with Mouse.
Oh, God. Yeah. Here, Animal Experimentation in the Holocaust. This is a great primer.
Yay!
But, I mean, it goes with those quite well, I think, because it's... Those are the darker side of comics, which are dealing with the darker side of humanity, animal cruelty.
John, what do you do for a second date? Have them read Fun Home?
It depends, really, what how the first date went. If it went terribly, then yes, I'd take that. Or to get him to read Pride of Baghdad.
Oh, God. No. We gotta do that one day.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, Jordan, you'd be fucked, mate.
Well, no, I will admit that's my pet project over the course of this series, is just how far down I can drive Jordan.
Why'd I be the lucky fucker?
Well, I'm going to do it to Dick, too, and you know it.
You won't even bother with John, because he's already too far gone.
No, he's going to be the one to help me do it.
Oh, great. So both of you are motherfuckers, then. Okay, I get you. That's fine.
That's the only reason I agreed to come on, was I got to destroy someone emotionally. And being an English person, that's how I get my power.
It's the pastime in England. I can attest to this as a
it really, is. It's an Olympic event.
And then, you know, we've still got, you know, Ava coming up.
We'll see, but that's the thing. Ava can't destroy a person emotionally.
They can scar them.
Maybe, but I mean, come on, fucking Ava's like clown shoes compared to the fucking crow.
True. What was it, Baby Time Frolics?
Yeah, it's Baby Time Frolics, comparatively. Which I'm surprised, nobody seems to know what the fuck that means.
You're fucking weirdos.
Yeah, it must be.
Yeah, Dizzy Man, would you suggest the crow to somebody?
Yeah, I would. But I would have to kind of explain that it... Because I think if you're retroactively going back and reading the crow now, I think you look at it and kind of see a lot of the imagery as being kind of, you know, gothy and cheesy and emo-y. Whereas you have to kind of... the crow is one of these pieces that you have to kind of, like, explain and understand that it kind of started a lot of this media. You know what I mean? In terms of any sort of, like... Just emotionally sort of strong narrative, you know what I mean? With that also has a lot of that sort of dark, stylistic sort of design in it, you know? That's the only caveat I'd give. But otherwise, absolutely. I think it's worth reading that 100%, you know? But it is. It's Debbie Downer time. You're not going to put it down and be like, yay, and go out, like, you know, pet a puppy and skip down the street. I think it's a sad story, so. But definitely, yeah, I'd recommend it if anyone had the time and they had a copy of the crow lying around. Definitely give it a read. It's iconic.
Well, folks, there you have it. This has been the first episode of Graded Point 5. We hope you enjoyed yourself, and if you did, go pick up the comic. Support your local comic shop. They need it, you know?
All three of them that are left.
And while you're at it, support the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. They're fighting for First Amendment rights in the comic industry, which is something we always need. I mean, this is a medium about free expression. So yeah, toss them a couple bucks. You know, help out the industry. Well, thank you all, and see you next week.